Welcome to the Storycraft Cafe. Come in, grab a cup of your favorite beverage, and get ready to join the storytelling conversation. Storycraft Cafe is brought to you by Dabble, the ultimate cloud-based fiction writing software. Here we're going to bring together storytellers from all walks to encourage and empower you to craft your best story. Welcome in to the Storycraft Cafe, your two hosts, Hank Garner, Doug Lansborough, here to have another one of our fireside chats. Neither one of us have a fire. Doug has a fireplace. It is not lit, but, you know, it was a fun title that kind of stuck for whatever reason. But we have had such a great time with this series of shows where we take a topic, and we were just laughing before we went live because we were saying that we come up with a topic. I come up with a list of things. Doug comes up with a list of things. We don't tell each other what we're thinking, and hilarity ensues. So welcome, Doug. Thanks for joining me again.
Thank you. I'm waiting. Backfires. That one of us just comes up with something so out of the blue or atrocious that the other one's just stunned.
Right. We're just like, how can I even? What were you thinking? So today we had an idea to talk about characters that are maybe a little unlikable, at least on the surface. And we can name a number of characters that have been used in popular fiction that seem to be sometimes just horrible people. And in the end, you sort of wind up rooting for them and cheering them on. And maybe it's a character arc that has some great redemption. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes the folks are just a cad, and that appeals to something in us. I don't know if that says more about the character or the writer or the reader. I'm not sure, but maybe some of each. So anyway, what immediately came to your mind, Doug, when we started talking about this topic?
What immediately came to my mind was actually redemption arcs. Funny that you mentioned it, because that...
I love a great redemption arc. I'm sorry.
Who doesn't, right? Like, they're so good. And I know from our chats while we're working that you just started watching Avatar: The Last Airbender, like the cartoon, right?
Yes.
How far into it are you?
Don't disappoint me. I just started season 3.
Okay. Oh, nice.
Yeah.
So you're well into then Prince Zuko's redemption, or at least the start of it, right?
Yes.
And I think that when you mention redemption arcs, you can't mention redemption arcs without mentioning that one, because it is so good. And something that people really love about redemption arcs is that you start so bad, and you are the villain. Zuko was the villain.
Right.
But he wasn't a twirl your mustache, I want to destroy the world villain. He was a villain that we could empathize with, that we could sympathize with. And then he changes over time into my favorite character in the series, probably. I know it's my wife's favorite character in the series. So there's power in that.
Absolutely. Speaking of that, a character that I think of pretty quickly is Severus Snape. That is a character that in the beginning you absolutely loathe. And then as the 7 books progress and the story unfolds, he's still not, and I find this interesting the way that Rowling did this. In the end, he's not necessarily a character that's your favorite, but there's something that connects with him that even though he's not your typical hero in shining armor, there's still something a little dark and twisted about him. But you have to respect where he's coming from. And I think that was well done.
Yeah, he's redeemed in the sense that his redemption arc is complete, but he does not turn into, I guess he is a hero because he dies for our hero. But he's not necessarily a great person. He's good. Right. He sacrifices himself, but if he were still alive, he'd still be kind of a jerk.
Right. He's kind of a jerk, but he does noble things. And yeah, and you have to appreciate that.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that he does well, and I think that a lot of redemption arcs do well, is this idea of sacrifice. Because if you've done terrible things, I think a reader or an audience member or a writer even wants you to atone for those more than just, oh, I've learned my lesson. Right? There needs to be almost like a punishment for what you've done to make you unlikable in the beginning in order to bring you back to the level where we can say, yeah, I really like you now.
Yeah. Do you think that we as readers or watchers or, you know, however we consume this piece of media, do you think that we like the punishment aspect? Do you think we like to see a character go through what we feel like is a proper redemption arc? They have to be punished. They have to feel bad for what they did, and then the good can come out of that? Or do you think it can be carried out another way?
I think there are some people that like it. They're really all about people getting their comeuppance. But I think more than that, it would feel empty without it. Like if there wasn't that retribution or that penance or that lesson learned, then we would feel like they didn't earn it or there's something missing more than anything else.
Right. Right. What's another character that you can think of that that has a great arc or that maybe doesn't have a great arc, but you find yourself rooting for them regardless of whether they're a good person or not?
Well, I think they do have a good
never arc. Standards.
Yeah, I think Loki in the Marvel movies and series, right? He started out as a very bad character, obviously the villain, but even from the get-go, we can see he's overshadowed by his brother. He's really doing this more for attention and to get on the same level as those around him than to really rule the world. And he had his kind of ebb and flow throughout the movies, but then when they actually launched the Loki TV show, and he was obviously the main character, we got to see a lot more about him. And that really solidified, hey, he was a villain, then he was an anti-hero, and now he's just, well, he's always been a great character, mostly because of the actor is Tom Hiddleston. Did I say that right?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. who doesn't love him, right? But I think that journey really showed a good example of villain to anti-hero still to not to spoil the end of season two of Loki for anyone that still hasn't seen it, but to a genuine hero that does sacrifice himself to the points we were just talking about, sacrifices himself to save everybody.
Get literally.
Literally, the multiverse.
Literally. The multiverse. He literally puts himself at the center of the hub and here's an interesting couple of characters that I thought about. The Lannister twins, Cersei and Jaime. In the beginning of that book series, well, and I can't say by the end because it'll never end, or the TV show, whatever. However, you're not sure if you like them or not. And then you find out, oh, I definitely don't like them. And then, you know, they through a series of events, it's almost like George Martin humanized them in a way. And in a way that he did not in the beginning. And you see all of their flaws and all of the horrible things that they've done for numerous reasons. But by humanizing them, it's like he gives us something to connect with them, and we can almost see our own shortcomings, and we feel empathy with them. And I think that's a good example of people that behave horribly. But we can at least connect to their humanity. It's an interesting arc that those two characters go through.
Yeah, and I mean, not to jump ahead, but you touched on one of my other points that I have jotted down here, which are flaws. And we can revisit this later because flaws are super important.
Oh, but of course.
For those two specifically.
Most of us have no shortage of them, so that's
yeah. I actually thought as I was writing my notes how much I tell my wife that she should be very happy with how much character potential I have because of all my flaws. So...
I love it.
With Jamie and Cersei, they are flawed and they are unlikable and then they change in very different ways. Right? Right. I'm mostly basing this off the TV show because I haven't read all the books. And we won't.
Nor will you ever.
Yeah, right.
Sorry, George. low hanging fruit.
But they grow in different ways, whereas Jaime has some of that redemption at the start, not necessarily intentionally, but we see from the beginning that there's almost like this nugget of good in him.
Yeah.
And then that kind of blossoms and we get more looks into that. I don't know if he necessarily becomes a full-fledged hero. I am struggling a little bit to remember some of those seasons, but... I know that his sister is so bad for so much of that movie, but at the same time, you hate her, but you enjoy hating her because she's so good at it.
Right.
And I think part of that, again, thinking about the TV show, it's played by Lena Headey, I believe, or she's played by Lena Headey, who does a fantastic job, right? Excellent job at that character. But it's interesting because you see her almost sophisticated evil versus her sons in the early season, Joffrey's, who was just a jerk, who was just for words no I can't say on stream.
right
And exactly. And that's different because he was just as unlikable, maybe more unlikable, but there was almost nothing likable about him. We enjoyed when he got his due.
Just evil personified.
Yeah. And then when Cersei had the whole shame incident, you felt sorry for her, not just because it was a graphic and terrible thing that happened, but because you're so attached to this character now, because you've also got her perspective on things. It's not just a villain that we encounter. It's someone whose perspective we have at that point.
Right. And there was a little bit of subtext there with her character that... there's a little bit of family preservation that played into that. And, you know, that you see this person in this horrible situation but in the end or somewhere along the way, she's just trying to protect what's hers. And, you know, in a weird, twisted way, you know, that there's something about that you can kind of respect. And, you know, it really makes you think about how you see the world when you see these other people and all of their messed up ways, you know, and I think it really helps you to process how you think about things as well, which is a whole other discussion. Well,
that's the point, right? Yeah, that's exactly. The point of unlikable characters that aren't just bad people.
Right.
And I think what you just mentioned there, you're hitting all my points today, Hank, is the motivation aspect. If you want an unlikable character to be liked or to be at least appreciated, their motivation has to make sense. And Joffrey, again, to juxtapose, had no real motivation aside from I've got a lot of power and I'm a child and I'm a twisted person. That's not motivation. That's just an unfortunate series of traits in one person. But Cersei had that motivation to keep the power in her family, to protect her son, to then protect her kingdom, to all these different things that if we were put in those same shoes, sure, maybe I wouldn't launch a whole war, you know, across several countries I don't want to say something that's going to come back and bite me later when like we have a kid, but like you can see, hey, this is something that's very important to her and she'll go to the ends of the earth to do it. And I think a lot of people have those elements in their life that they might not do the same thing because they physically can't, but they can relate to it.
Right. Here's a character that I found on some online lists that I don't necessarily agree with, but I wanted to get your perspective on this. And that's Holden Caulfield from Catcher in the Rye. It has been 30 years since I read that book, and I detested it when I read it. I hated Catcher in the Rye. There was I could not understand why people raved about this book and why it went on to be this cult, you know, hit or whatever. And I hated the character of Holden Caulfield. So this one that I disagreed with people, and I truly want to hear what you think about Holden Caulfield.
So it has been at least half my life since I read that book. Yeah, and I remember I had to look up his character for an article that we had on W, and I'm struggling here, but correct me if I'm wrong. He's a pretty, isn't he like an angsty teenager?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. So
for no good reason.
Well, is anyone an angsty? I mean, I guess there are some angsty teenagers that are justified, but as an angsty teen, when I read it, I could relate to that. Right. I the world didn't understand me. I had all these thoughts and ideas, and everyone should just listen to me. And mom and dad, stop treating me like I'm a kid, even though I have homework to do and I need your permission to go to this field trip. Like, I think anytime you have angst or anytime you have that rebellious nature, you will have people that gravitate towards it.
Yeah. Do you think that Holden had, other than just an angsty teenager relating to an angsty teenager, was there anything about that character that had, did he need a redemption arc, or did he just serve a place for other people to relate to? Like, it was an arc necessary for him, or is it just a reflection of the reader?
I'm trying so hard to remember this book right now.
I know. I really struggled with digging those memories.
I need a summary. This is what I'm talking about when I said it's going to come back to bite us, because if I had a weekend to refresh myself on Catcher in the Rye, we would have been, been golden. I don't know. I truly don't know. But I think it can't be undervalued how much a placeholder character can be for the reader. Like a lot of characters, that's the entire intention, right? To put ourselves in their shoes. So if that is all he is to somebody, then that's fine. I think it's done successfully. I also don't remember having the same passionate distaste for this book that you do. So I don't know. My poor memory might not be as tainted as yours.
Well, that was my hot take for the day. So that's out of the way. You know, feel free to drop yours when you want. But do you have another character you'd like to explore?
Let's see. A character that is unlikable, but then turns likable. I'm trying to think about something that's a little more common. I went for more of the craft aspect for this, this talk. But let me think about it as we keep chatting, and then I'll suddenly interrupt you.
What about Jay Gatsby from The Great Gatsby?
Yeah, from The Great Gatsby. Well, of course. I think as a modern Doug who has very polarized opinions on something, I would read The Great Gatsby today and strongly dislike Jay Gatsby. A younger Doug who was very enamored with, this is how, you know, the rich live, and this is what happens when you have enough money to have power and you can do whatever you want. I think that aspect, that you can see potential in a character like him. And I think that's really alluring to people, because at the end of the day, he's not a good person. I don't know. What are your thoughts on Mr. Gatsby?
Same. There's something kind of darkly alluring about that character, maybe, that resonates with people. But in the end, he's not a great guy, and you just have to. I think that's it's more the the forbidden pleasure aspect, maybe that makes some characters kind of the reason like that we like heist movies. You know, usually heist movies, they're fantastic, and we love all of the machinations that go into putting together a great heist. But usually somebody's stealing from somebody else. You know, it's not a good thing generally.
On a grand scale.
On a grand scale, you know, it's usually, and you can find a way to, you know, think that it's a Robin Hood sort of, you know, story. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, it's not a good situation, but we love it anyway. And I think there's a bit of that about Gatsby that we like, that's just kind of the, you know, maybe we shouldn't, but we do.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of a heist movie now. And I don't think I've ever read a heist book. So I'm only thinking about movies where the heist isn't being done for a grander reason, right? Either the company they're stealing from is evil, or it's a parent trying to make ends meet and this is their last job or something. Like that's kind of the tie-in to make this unlikable action of theft into something that we can understand. And again, it goes back to the motivation.
Right.
It's if you can justify why someone's doing what they're doing, it makes the unlikable a lot more tolerable, a lot more palatable, if not like a good thing. And I'm trying to think about Jay Gatsby, and I can't. I'm struggling to think of motivation that makes me want to like him. So,
yeah, there's a bit of the someone who's not supposed to be somewhere getting to be there. You know, there's a little of that delicious, you know, aspect that, oh, he's kind of cracked the code and he gets to, you know, to be where he's not wanted. There's a little bit of that. I don't know, but you know, it's been around forever and it has, you know, stood the test of time. There's something about that character or those characters that people love. Yeah. So maybe that's an exploration for another day. Speaking though, if you've never read, a heist novel. The guy that wrote the Dexter series of books, Jeff Lindsay, is that his name? Jeff Lindsay writes another series that's heist novels, and they're fantastic. Okay. If you get a chance if you're ever looking for some, that's your recommendation for today.
And Jeff Lindsay, his name. There's like a whole cinematic heist universe on Netflix that I've seen, Money Heist, that I've never seen. So someone's going to be like, well, they didn't do it for good reasons. They're just, but that's fine.
I'm thinking of the Ocean's movies, Ocean's 11, you know, where they're robbing casinos, you know, I mean, there are no good guys in that, you know, the casinos you could argue are terrible people and, you know, not to offend anyone out there that owns a casino that might be watching and is working on their first novel.
But in that same regard, in that case, it's either viewed as the greater evil, generally headed by someone who has too much money to know what they can do with, or what we really like about those characters then is that they have a particular set of skills that makes them almost superhero in nature, right? Right.
It's gathering the team of those people that each one has a specialty and we just love to see it.
I had a character in mind.
Okay.
Actually, I had a character in mind that is so unlikable that I'm shocked it made it into two movies. And I don't know if you ever saw Prometheus, like the sequel, prequel to Alien.
Did it's been a, when it first came out, so it's been 10 years,
7, 8, 10 years, something so like the that. Android in it, David, is so wholeheartedly unlikable, and in it, I guess this is more a thing about if you're going to write an unlikable character, don't do this, because throughout the movie, he doesn't do anything redeeming, he doesn't do anything endearing to the viewers or other characters. He is just scheming and plotting the whole time, and then he ruins everyone's lives. Like it is a sequence of unlikable events, and then they brought him back for the sequel to that movie, which was I can't remember the name anymore, but he was just bad still. He just lured them there to then experiment on them more with alien stuff or something like that. And you can tell that my passion for this movie now is just disliking this character. And that's what lingers. There was just no logic behind the motivation. There was no redemption. There were no necessarily any flaws in the character other than he's just bad. So,
right.
I don't know. Well, that was my hot take.
Maybe we need to add another classification for unlikable characters and just put under the hate watch.
Yeah.
I just hate them and I just watch it just to get to hate watch it.
That's what I'm going to do after this. I'll go hate watch it.
Right. I think I have one more. How about Tyler Durden from Fight Club?
Yeah. Okay.
That's a morally complex character. Let's just say.
And he provides, objectively, I think if you look at it from a 1,000-foot view, bad guy, right? Not a good person. But as you zoom in closer and closer, he represents the freedom that everybody kind of wants at a base level. I don't want to get super philosophical or anything here, but we all have to live within, and I mean, it's the theme of the movie and the book, but we all have to live within these boundaries that are established to be in a successful and prosperous society.
Right.
And he represents what happens if I can do whatever I want. And people like that, because they can read about it and suffer no consequences. In real life, we can't do that. So he is, again, a stand-in for the reader to experience the thrill of a life without rules. And we as people appreciate that fictionally.
Right, fictionally, yeah.
Yeah.
And what's the first rule of Fireside Chats? Yeah, we don't talk about it.
We don't.
So
we'll beat each other up after.
right. So now that we've kind of identified some characters that people might be able to relate to, as writers, how can we include these sorts of characters into our story while giving the reader some complexity to latch onto? Just some notes that I jotted down. I said these characters are often selfish, morally ambiguous, or even villainous, but their complexity, depth, and the way they challenge readers' expectations make them unforgettable and fascinating to explore. So how can we do that? And kind of famously, I have the Save the Cat Writes a Novel book here on my shelf, and that title Save the Cat came from the original book, which was talking about screenwriting, not novel writing, which I don't actually own the original book. But the term Save the Cat came from, if I'm not mistaken, that if you have a character that you really want viewers, because we're talking about screenwriting, you really want viewers to resonate with, to latch on to, give them something heroic to do early in the movie. Maybe they seem to be a horrible character, but stick a cat in a tree and have them save the cat. Mm-hmm. And then they instantly, and it is kind of a tongue-in-cheek thing that, you know, went on to have a life of its own, obviously. But is it that easy? I always kind of thought of that, and it's like, well, that seems cheap. But is it that easy? Do you find it takes more than that to?
Yeah. I think it definitely loyalty. Does. Yeah, and I think that worked 40, 50 years ago. Like storytelling has evolved, and the consumption of stories has exploded. So people are more critical, and it's happening more often than ever before. So if I were to write a story today, and I just had my villain, you know, save a cat from a tree, or help an old woman cross the road, or do something very small in terms of a morally good action, and then went on to have them be just this terrible human being, that wouldn't jive. Readers wouldn't understand. There's no consistency there. right? But what you mentioned at the start of this part of the fireside chat is that you need a complex character. You need to layer a character if you want them to be unlikable but likable. If you want them to be bad but the favorite of half your readership, right? You need backstory, you need motivation, you need flaws, you need character traits, you need relationships, you need a million different things.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, right.
So, sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I didn't mean to.
No, it's just you, if you are going to cop out and just have them save the cat, for lack of a better analogy, then it's going to fall flat. And you're not just going to have an unlikable character, but you're going to have an unlikable character that your readers are confused why they did this one simple thing that's so out of character for them.
Right. So here's a question. Say you're writing a fantasy series. Let's just, because I think that's a great vehicle for for characters that have these big character arcs. Mm-hmm. And say you've got an antagonist in book one that you know that in book three is going to have a huge change and that readers are going to love. How do you get readers to stay on board in book one when you as the writer know that down the road you've got this thing that's really going to pay off and readers are going to love it? But will they stick around for that? You know, what do you do to build this attachment for readers to have to this character while not just losing them because this person is heinous? And you know, I mean, how do you get readers to stay for the full the character arc?
It's like you custom made this question for me, because in my current series I have the antagonist in book one and I'm writing book three right now, and he is at that moment, he's at that turning point where he goes from villain to almost anti-hero, I want to say. And he's got a couple more books to work on that. But I still remember after I wrote my first book, the villain's name is Dante. And I got tagged in a tweet back when I had Twitter that said, well, love this book. It was so much fun. Love the villain, hashtag Team Dante. And I thought that was one of the proudest moments of my life that a stranger just made up this hashtag about my villain. Right. And he is one of my favorite characters to write, but it's because I give him that screen time in the book. I think if you want to make that sort of broad villain to not villain shift, have scenes or chapters from their perspective and treat them just like you would your protagonist, right? Back to the backstory, relationships, motivations, especially. If you have a villain that doesn't have at least an understandable motivation, if not a relatable one, it's not going to work ever in a million years.
Well, one thing that I've heard that's kind of become trite because it's been said and reset and used so many times is every character is the hero of their own story. is that a bit what you're talking about, that you give this character screen time, page time, you explore backstory, motivations, so that the readers can see because most of the times, and there are exceptions, most of the time antagonist or bad guys, if we want to say it like that, are not doing things just because they're evil. Of course there are characters that are evil just for evil's sake. Most of the time though, the more interesting characters are evil for another reason. Is that what you're saying? Explore the other reason from their perspective.
And what I've done specifically is it made him aware that he knows what he's doing isn't good, but he's doing it anyway because he feels like he needs to, and he feels like that is his purpose. And I don't want to dive into the whole plot or character arc, but if you make your villain aware like that, or if you make a bad guy aware like that, then it lends even more weight, I think, to the motivation. But you need to support it with their actions, with their dialogue, with their backstory, what happened before the book even started, to make them that way. Because it's a very like delicate structure. And it can come crumbling down really easily if just like one of those bricks is out of place. And that's something that I'm very cognizant of when I'm writing these scenes. And I think that's true for all characters. Like everything kind of has to be in place. But if you're trying to build a very specific type of character, like an empathetic villain, then you really need to focus on the parts that are drawing in that empathy.
Right. One thing that I have found great success in writing these sorts of characters is to use humor or wit for this darker character. And that helps people to find a connection there, because we all love to, you know, throw snark and shade. And, you know, if you can get a character who can do that, you know, unabashedly with abandon and say the things that we've always wanted to say, even if it's not right, even if we know that our mother would be terribly embarrassed by us, you know, that's always fun and can likely, you know, endear a character to readers.
Yeah. And I think you see it most often. This is going to sound fantasy-ish, but it's not just fantasy, but in that like charming or dashing highwayman kind of trope, where they're robbing you at gunpoint, taking all your valuables, but they're flirting, they're smiling, they're cracking jokes at the same time. Right. Like, okay, you're doing a bad thing. You're threatening my life and taking my property, but you're funny and you're cute. And so like we're automatically endeared to that character. And a lot of the time, that character can then take the weight off of really dark situations that maybe they themselves caused or they deserve to be in. But that makes it more palatable for us as readers as well. So it gives us that time to explore.
Absolutely. internal dialogue. Sometimes that is helpful to explore a character's motivations, and then that helps. But I think I say that with trepidation, because that can be overused. I'm thinking about fantasy specifically. You know, we've all read fantasy books where this internal monologue goes on for pages and pages and pages, and they just, you know, they're the supervillain, you know, mustache twirling monologue, you know, as you've got Superman tied up with you know, with kryptonite chains, you monologue and tell everything that you've ever wanted to do, you know, while Superman's, you know, fiddling with the lock or something. And then, you know, so that has to be, I think internal monologue, or, you know, exploring how this character is thinking to himself or herself, as opposed to what he projects to the world. You know, I think that can be very handy. You just have to be careful not to overdo it.
Yeah, you have to be careful not to overdo it. And you have to make sure that you're doing it in the right place. So
and in the right context.
Yeah, exactly. And to build this character, I'm assuming it's a villain this whole time, but it could be just a crass, unlikable secondary character, right? But if it is the villain, if you are giving them their own scenes, because they need their own scenes, first of all, from their perspective, if you're going to have any kind of internal monologue. If they're just monologuing at someone, that's fine. It can be from the perspective of the hero of Superman fiddling with his locks. but then you need to balance out your book around having different perspectives in it, which is something that people can do really well. It's something that I love reading, and some people absolutely hate it. So you need to practice that and make sure that there's a good balance throughout, because you also don't want to have this villain for two acts and then in the third act, out of nowhere, have a scene from their perspective where they're suddenly saying, yeah, I'm trying to burn the city down because of this really sad thing that happened to me 20 years ago. Like that, you need the consistency in that as well.
Yeah. Here's another one. Give the... the character a strong moral code. Even if a character makes questionable decisions, showing that they have a strong sense of morality or a personal code they adhere to can make them more likable and respectable. A couple of examples I thought about was Marvel's Punisher or John Wick. Someone that does horrible, heinous things, but for the right reason. You know, I was thinking about those two properties specifically. No one can argue that they're doing the right thing, you know, but
we could understand why they're doing it.
We could understand. Exactly. Exactly.
And it's interesting because those two characters are similar in that they are both assassins or killers, sure. But they are very different in their morals as well. So you have the Punisher, who, if you didn't understand his motivation, is a heinously awful villain. Absolutely disgusting. But because you understand the motivation, you can side with him at times. You might not like his means. You might like his means. I don't know. But you can understand why he's doing it. And his code is in his name. It's punishment, right? And he sticks to that. John Wick, on the other hand, almost went through like a reformation. He was that bad guy, and then he got out of it. He was living the good life, and then he was dragged back into it. His moral code was forcefully shifted by an external presence, right? And I think both end up in the same place, but who they were beforehand and the morals that they during it are very different, but both are very likable as a result.
Yeah, and never mess with a man's dog.
Never. I wasn't going to say it, but if anyone messed with my dog, I might have to dig up the garage.
Yeah. All bets are off.
Exactly.
Yeah.
who's your favorite out of the two? Punisher or John Wick?
John Wick. I think, I would you know, Keanu Reeves is endearing on his own. Yeah. You know, he's so huggable. And
even as he's shooting, I was going to say, I actually, of the two, I love Keanu Reeves. I think he's a national treasure. But the Punisher, because there's such that traumatic background to him, and because it's such a visceral response, that is such an interesting character to me. That is so fascinating. And the fact that the Punisher too, I just said when we were talking about Save the Cat, that, you know, that motivation would, or that display of moral would work 40, 50 years ago. The Punisher, the character, is something like 40 or 50 years old at this point, maybe even older. And his backstory, it's changed a little. I don't read all the comics, but it's changed a little over time, but it's been the core thing since the beginning, the core event of his family. And so that's an interesting case study in a likable, terrible character, if anyone wants to dive deep on that.
Yeah. Here's another one I wrote down. Highlight their positive relationships. Show the characters' interactions with others, particularly any positive relationships they may have. This can help readers see a different side of a character and understand their capacity for kindness or compassion. I was thinking about a character specifically when I wrote this one, and I cannot for the life of me remember what the book was, but there was a character that was a villain or seemed to be on the surface, and then when he would come home, he had an ailing mother that he was taking care of, and you got to see that his actions during the day were because he was trying to provide for this ailing mother. And you know, as twisted as that relationship, you know, wound up being, there was something that was innately human about that, and it just made you want to root for him in a weird way. And it was it made me very conflicted as a reader, and I think that was the entire purpose, was to make me want to keep coming back to the page to find out what was going to happen next. And I'll think of, as soon as this is over, I know it'll pop in my head what story that was, but I, I've I remember the relationship specifically, even if I can't remember who it was. But that just always stuck with me, the way that the writer brought out those characteristics of the character were really well done.
Well, and you mentioned Dexter before, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure he had that same kind of vulnerability with his sister. And I think that this works so effectively because you can have a monster, but then show that there is a chip in the armor, right? Or a crack in the wall. And that means that there is potential for more as well. So it humanizes them, but it gives us something to look forward to if that redemption arc comes in. Or as a writer, it opens up a way to absolutely devastate this character and turn them into even more of a monster if the story calls for it. That's my kind of story, Hank. That's the kind of story that I write. So
that's so funny.
But you can even consider that like a flaw for a bad character to have this kind of vulnerability. To them, they might consider it a flaw. And them considering it a flaw might be a flaw from a characterization point of view. Like there's many, there's onion levels of layers in this that you can exploit as a writer. And it's all about just staying away from that mustache twirler.
Right.
If you take away anything from this, it's don't just write a villain that's villainous or a bad guy that's bad or add something.
Don't write two-dimensional characters.
Yeah, right. Unless they're the cabbage guy from Avatar.
Another thing I wrote, show their loyalty, but that kind of plays into the previous one. You know, loyalty to friends, family, or a cause that makes them more likable. That's just kind of a tack on to the previous one. Create a sense of mystery, giving a character an intriguing or mysterious background. That kind of goes with everything else we've said, but as a way of drawing out the character arc or giving the readers the sense that there's more to this character. I'm just not telling you what it is yet, but there's, build intrigue there which again is kind of playing with, you're playing with the reader's expectation that there's going to be more to this character, even if I, as the writer, don't know what that is yet. if I'm in more of a pantser mode and I'm exploring this character as I write him, maybe it's a good thing to add in some of that mystery and intrigue and allude to some big change that's coming, even if I haven't figured out what that big change is yet.
Yeah, and I think this touches back to Jay Gatsby as well. One of the reasons that he's more likable is because we don't know a whole lot about him. If we knew from page one, like, oh, there's this rich guy on the other side of the river that was born into wealth and just throws these parties because he likes women and drinks and drugs, then he will remain unlikable for time immemorial, right? He can sacrifice himself to save a baby, and he will still be unlikable. But because we want to know more, we're like drawn in. We appreciate the individual character traits more. We want to see what they'll do next, and we don't know what they'll do next. So,
right. The unpredictability of a character is a great tool to use as well. Yep. Never knowing what they're going to do. Did you ever read Gone Girl by Gillian Flynn?
No, my better half did. Okay. She really liked it.
Well, Gone Girl really shifted the psychological thriller space in that every book since then has been under the umbrella of the unreliable narrator, or at least forced to occupy the space that Gone Girl occupies in there. And people, anytime they read a book like that, they're immediately suspicious of the narrator because Gone Girl did it so well that the first half of the book, you believe this world is one way. And then the flip happens in the middle of the book, and then all bets are off. You have no idea who anybody is, really, what this world is like. Everything you thought you knew, you are immediately distrustful of. And, you know, it just all bets are off. I mean, she just completely flipped the genre on its head, all by using this narrator that you had built trust in and loyalty to, and then have the rug pulled out from under you. So that's, it's a bit of the opposite of what we're talking about. She built this loyalty, this reader loyalty, and then, you know, yanks it away from us halfway through the book. And then, you know, you're trying to figure out who anybody is or who they really are at, you know, after this point. So that I had just written down the narrator, you know, how you play with who's narrating the story can depend greatly on whether people latch onto a character, or they like them or trustful of them or find them distrustful. Your narrator plays a big part in that.
Yeah. And there is the unreliable narrator. And then there is a narrator that just, unless they are an omniscient third person narrator,
right,
they are innately biased or unreliable on some things. Like, right, if you take Little Red Riding Hood, the wolf is a monster. If you tell it from the wolf's perspective, the wolf's hungry, right? The wolf's just doing what it was made to do, kind of thing. Right. And that those are two very different tales. But I think you can really play with that too when making these likable, unlikable characters by showing us two different perspectives of the character, one from in their head, or maybe someone adjacent to them, and one from the protagonist's head, or another side character or something, and give us those two different polarities that we can play with and let the reader come to their own opinion, and then kind of just smack them over the head with something. drop the bomb towards the end. I am trying to think, though, like I read, is it Where the Crawdads Sing? A couple years ago.
Delia Owens.
Maybe. Yeah, I believe so. Let me just see the cover. Yep, that's it. And towards the end, there's the big reveal, and you realize that our narrator hasn't necessarily been truthful the whole way along. And right, I enjoyed the twist. I think a lot of people saw it coming, kind of, but I don't know if I liked the character after that came out. And I don't know how I necessarily felt about the book as a whole when this character that we were rooting for suddenly became unlikable, but we were expected from 95% of the book to continue liking them.
Well, it sold 40 bajillion copies.
So, right. Like, who am I?
Right. I had the same thoughts, but, you know, people just kept buying boxes and boxes of them. So, you know,
and it was an enjoyable read. Don't get me wrong. I think the book was good. I think I was enwrapped in it. But I just don't know if, like, I can't say that I like that character now that,
yeah,
not only was it revealed that they did something that is justifiable after you read the book, but like, you just lied to us for however many hundreds of pages. And I think that's I don't know. I'm trying to think of a way to tie this back into our conversation here, because I think it has a point, but I'm losing the thread as I'm speaking. So, but do you know what I'm saying, Hank? Can you save me here?
Yes. I know what you're saying. Like, the unreliable narrator has become a staple in this certain genre, and it has to be handled carefully because readers are suspicious, and you're going to find more and more people trying more, you know, elaborate ways to pull the rug out from under readers. But, you know, handle those things carefully, and give, you know, when you do that, when you completely shake up your story, do it for a reason. Make sure that there's a something that the reader is at least left to wrestle with or ponder at the end, and not just close the book and say, well, that was a cheap shot that the writer, you know, tried.
And then he woke up from his dream. don't do that. I guess what I was trying to say with it, that came to me like, well, you forced it upon me with your brilliance. The character doesn't have to be likable. It can just be an unlikable character. The book is still good, even though I don't like the character because of the last two pages.
Yeah.
And that's an effective storytelling.
And life is generally good. And there are characters in life that are just unlikable. It's just a fact of nature.
Yeah. Like people who don't say good morning to you when you're walking your dog past them and you say good morning.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think we've covered all the bases that I had.
I had one last thing, and I'll just touch on this just briefly. Make them an underdog. I said readers often root for underdogs. But the more I thought about that, then you have the tendency for an underdog to overplay their hand. And an underdog, if not treated correctly or nurtured correctly, will become a bully. And you've got, you know, we could name any schoolyard bully that we find out was bullied, you know, himself when he was younger. And and that is something for us to watch out for in our own characters. If we've got an underdog and if not given the proper attention in their character growth, they can then become, you know, an evil character just for evil's sake, or it seems. So anyway, that's it didn't go where I thought it was going to go. But anyway,
no, but I think it raises a valid point in that if you're trying to make an unlikable character likable, you need to make sure you're not venturing into cliche territory.
Right.
Because there are five different ways you can do it. And if you just do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's been done a million times before. We all like the schoolyard bully that has issues at home or a traumatic past can make for an effective character, but we've read that and we've watched that so many times at this point that it's not saving the cat, right? Maybe it went save the cat to schoolyard bully with bad home life to whatever the next iteration is, but you can see that saving the cat is a simple act and schoolyard bully with a bad home life is more complex than that. And I think as we write more and more as a collective society of writers, you need to focus on more complexity, on more depth, not necessarily just complexity, but depth, right? Think about that reasoning. Think about things that people haven't put together before, or take time to just develop that character. Right? It's not just the schoolyard bully with a rough home life, but he's also working two part-time jobs to pay for groceries for his sister because his dad, you know, finds the bottom of the bottle every night. And then he has to go to the kid that he's bullying to get help with homework because he's so tired he can't study anymore. Like, there are so many things you can layer on there.
Right.
It just takes time. Just don't be cliche with it.
Absolutely. Don't be cliche.
That's it.
If you take anything away from this discussion, don't be cliche. And that, kind viewers and listeners, has been our discussion this week on how to make characters likable even when they don't deserve it. Join us again a couple of weeks from now, where Doug and I will take another topic and beat it into submission. And I think we have a topic coming up, but we'll announce that soon. And be sure to join us then. Doug, as always, thanks for joining me.
Thank you, Hank.
That's our episode for today. There's so much more to come as we talk to authors about the craft of writing, but also the business of publishing. Be sure to subscribe to the Storycraft Cafe podcast in your favorite podcast app so that you never miss an episode. The Storycraft Cafe is made possible by Dabble. Writing a book is challenging. Your writing tool should not be. Dabble is an easy-to-use online writing tool packed with helpful features that allow beginning novelists and published authors to create amazing stories. Visit us at dabblewriter.com and start your free trial today. Thanks for listening.